Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the 2009 Alaska Whammy Mini Medical School Series. Representing Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho, Whammy is a collaborative medical school among universities in five northwestern states, and this month, they're hosting a public lecture series at Providence Hospital in Anchorage. Kicking off the first of the four-part series, Dr. Tim Hinterberger invited Alaskans to take a tour of the brain. Recorded this past Tuesday, October 6th, Dr. Tim Hinterberger answers, why are our brains wired the way they are?
I'd like to welcome everybody to our annual mini medical school.
My name is Dennis Valenzino, and I'm the director of the Alaska Whammy program at UAA, where I'm also the associate dean for medical and pre-medical programs in the College of Arts and Sciences. Whammy is our medical school. It's a collaborative medical school. It encompasses five states. Six different institutions are involved in this medical school. It's been in place since 1971, when classes began actually at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The Alaska program originated in Fairbanks and moved to Anchorage in 1989. Tonight, we have the pleasure of hearing one of our first-year faculty, Dr. Tim Hinterberger, who I said teaches our nervous system course. He also teaches, he's a multiple threat, he also teaches our histology course for us. Dr. Hinterberger was educated at the University of Illinois, Urbana. He did postdoctoral work at the University of Michigan and also at Purdue before he joined the faculty at UAA, where he's an associate professor in Whammy, and also has an appointment in biological sciences. Like most Whammy faculty, because of the multi-institutional nature of the beast, he's also an affiliate professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Dr. Hinterberger is a reviewer for several journals in his field, and he has recently been awarded a prestigious grant from the National Institutes of Health, an area grant to fund the research work that he does. If you push, you might even get him to talk a little bit about that. But tonight, we're going to hear from him an explanation of why our brain is wired the way it is. So, Dr. Hinterberger.
Thanks, Dennis. And thanks to all of you for coming out this evening. I know that you can, you know, stay home and watch shows about how the brain works on the Discovery Channel or public television. So I appreciate you coming out and joining us tonight. I picked the title, Why Are Brains Wired the Way That They Are, just because that's a terribly fascinating question that neuroscientists around the world are working on and have been working on for many years. And I'll tell you right now, I'm not going to be able to give you probably a satisfactory answer, but my goal really more is to tell you about how neuroscientists think about this kind of problem and to think about different approaches to addressing it. What do we mean by our brains are wired? This is a term that people use nowadays, you know, as a shorthand. I'm wired for that, or it's just the way I'm wired. And I think we all know that our brains have cells, neurons that connect to each other, but actually visualizing that wiring is worthwhile to help us think about how this might take place. And I'm going to introduce a lot of terminology here. So this is a chance for you to learn and take something away from this. One of the major pathways in your brain that connects your cerebral cortex to everything below it is called the internal capsule. You can see then these fibers running from the cortical surface down to the deeper part of the brain where they can then go down into the brainstem and connect with even the spinal cord. So internal capsule is a nice place to see the wiring. And the terminology can seem daunting and overwhelming, but the trick is to understand the structure of the terminology. So, for instance, this these terms, retrolenticular and sublenticular. Retro, that means what? Behind, right? In back. Sub means below. And so these are saying exactly where these parts of the capsule are with respect to the lenticular nuclei. These structures that have been removed here, the putamen and the globus pallidus, are the lenticular nuclei. So the part of the internal capsule that's behind them is the retrolenticular, and below them is the sublenticular internal capsule. So just when you see these terms, don't be overwhelmed by them. Try to pick them apart and say, what's the root of that? What is that referring to? We talk a lot about tracts. The wiring isn't random. Connections from one part of the brain don't just sort of intermingle with connections that are going somewhere else and then sort themselves out. They run together in tracts, and this probably is a cue to the information that's required by those axons when they're forming those connections. They run together. So if they start out from the same place and they run together to the same target, then each axon doesn't have to figure out the pathway for itself. They can all work on it as a group. So we talk about pathways and tracts. So, for instance, here's one called the corticospinal tract. And here's another cue about understanding the terminology that you might come across in reading about brain structures. When we see the name of a tract, which we know that a tract refers to a bundle of axons going from one place to another, the first part of the name says where it's coming from, and the second part of the name says where it's going to. So corticospinal, that tells us that it's going from the cortex to the spinal cord. Here's another figure on the right, and this shows a couple then particular pathways, motor pathways, going. So what would motor be doing? That would be telling the body how to move, right? Be controlling the muscles. And so that information is going from the brain to the body. So that's actually, we could say that the corticospinal tract is a motor pathway. It's going from the cortex to the spinal cord to control the neurons in the spinal cord that actually control the muscles. The other one that's shown there is somatosensory. So sensory tells us that we're getting information from the outside and bringing it to our brains. So we have pathways going from the cortex out, motor pathways, and we have sensory pathways coming in. What about that somato part? If you know a little bit of your, I don't know, is that Latin or Greek? Anyway, soma refers to the body. So this is sensation from the body, somatosensory. Each side of the brain has a homunculus, has a map that are very similar to each other. So why is there a map on each side? And as you may know from your studies and reading and common knowledge, that our one side of the brain is connected to the body on the other side. So again, here's our primary motor cortex that we were just looking at, and here's our corticospinal tract that sends axons down through the internal capsule, going down through the internal capsule into the brainstem, and there's a region called the medulla. We'll see that that's one of the major parts of the brainstem. And these bulges on the front of the medulla are called the medullary pyramids. And so there's a region here where there's what's called the pyramidal decussation. Boy, there's a big word. Decussation, that's just one that you have to learn because I don't think it's related to anything else in common usage. And that just means where the axons cross from one side to the other. And this is where the axons from, in this case, the left side of the brain cross to the right side of the spinal cord so that they control the muscles, the nerves and the muscles on the right side of the body. So this is a common feature in our central nervous systems, not only for our descending motor information, but also for the sensory information going back up, also for our visual system. Much of the information crosses from one eye to the brain on the other side. So it's interesting to think about why this has to happen, why each side of the body is primarily connected with the opposite side of the brain. And it's interesting to look and see that this is not something that's unique to humans. It's not unique to mammals. You have a question? Is there a question? Yeah. Go ahead.
Aren't left-handed people opposite?
Well, no. In both cases, the left side of the brain controls the right side of the body. The right side of the brain controls the left side of the body. But what you're getting, what you're asking about is differences in the role of the left versus the right side of the brain. And a good example of that is our language part of the brain. So even though one side of the brain is connected to the other side of the body, they're not perfectly symmetrical. There's asymmetry in the brain. And a lot of this asymmetry is thought to allow one side of the brain to specialize and to make a more efficient system. If one side of the brain can specialize for one activity, the other side of the brain can specialize in some other activity. And an example of that very clearly is language. And that's been seen for many years due to, for instance, the effects of people who have an injury on one side of the brain, a stroke or a traumatic injury on one side of the brain. If it's on the left side, it's much more likely to affect language than if it's on the right side. So even people who, so most people who are right-handed, like 95 or more, almost 100% of people who are right-handed have the language area on the left brain. Even most people who are left-handed, 75 or 80% have the language area on the left side. So there's a real tendency for that to happen, and we really don't know why. It's reflected in common differences in the even the gross anatomy of the brain. Here we see that this fissure, the left lateral sulcus, extends further back and creating this region called the planum temporale, which we really don't see on the right side of the brain. Of course, nowadays, the way that people look at regionalization or localization of function in the brain is with functional imaging. So we could have a whole separate lecture about imaging, about MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, compared to other kinds, and what it means to be a functional magnetic resonance. Very often what these machines capture is changes in blood flow localized to certain parts of the cortex. So it turns out that when a group of neurons is active because its specialized activity is called for, like speech or in the case of the lower set of figures here, this was it says a geometry task. The study patient or study subjects were asked to decide exactly where to bisect a line, and their activity of their brain was imaged while they were doing these tasks. The upper one is a language, a set of language tasks, word selection, or something like that. So here we see that, so this is the right side of the brain, this is the top view, and the left side, and we see that for the language tasks, the activity is very strongly biased towards the left side of the brain. In fact, two particular areas that you may recognize if you've had any psychology courses, Wernicke's area, that's important for understanding language, and then Broca's area, which is important for producing language. And so people who have an injury in either of these particular sites long ago were recognized as having difficulties in that particular sort of language task. So let's get back to our question, which is, why are our brains wired the way that they are? And any question that begins with why can often be answered in quite a few different ways. So let me give you one way of answering this question. Our brains are wired the way they are because that's the way that we evolved. And if we think about language, those language areas that we were just looking at, there's been a lot of thought and speculation that because humans are sort of uniquely equipped for language, that perhaps this lateralization or specialization of the brain, one side versus the other, arose in human evolution, that it's part of what allows our brains to do this language thing. Maybe lower animals don't have laterally specialized brains. So scientists have been looking at that. And in fact, there is evidence from studies of lots of animals, elephants, monkeys, dogs, that many animals seem to have a paw preference or a foot preference for certain tasks, just like humans are either right-handed or left-handed. So it may very well be that specialization of one side of the brain versus the other goes way back in evolution, long before humans appeared. And in fact, there was an article in Scientific American just back in July, I took these figures from it, showing that even lower vertebrates like frogs in some studies show evidence of having a specialized response on one side of the brain or the other. So in this case, here's the frog, and it was being presented with a threat, a rubber snake head, on the left side or the right side. And on the right side, when the snake appeared there, again, that would involve visual processing on the left side of the brain, it was relatively slow to respond. But when the snake had appeared on the left side and the visual field transferred that information to the right side of the brain, there was a more prompt escape response. In contrast to that fright escape function, when the task presented to the frog was something routine like feeding, it struck more quickly when the prey came from the right, suggesting that the opposite side of the brain was involved in that. So this is an area that some scientists are looking at, trying to understand when specialization of one side of the brain or the other first arose, and why. What is the reason? Is it because it allows the brain to be more efficient, division of labor, or is there a more ancient reason than that? Is there something about the way the brain develops that requires that? We just don't know, and it'll be interesting to see what people come up with. So that's one way of answering the question why our brains wired the way that they are, because that's the way that we evolved. There were selection pressures over the course of evolution, even before humans, that led the individuals who had the particular characteristics to be more successful and pass their genes on. Another way of answering the question, though, of why are our brains wired the way they are, it doesn't have anything to do directly with evolution. It's just to look at an individual organism developing and say that our brains are wired the way that they are because that's how we develop. And, of course, the wiring, the connectivity of the brain is an important step in creating the brain. The brain has to, the whole embryo develops from a single cell that divides, becomes many cells, and becomes certain layers of cells. And then in the case of the brain, the upper layer folds and makes a tube, and then the front part becomes the brain and develops all its shapes. But even after that is all done and the brain is shaped or partly shaped, it still needs to grow the axons out from the neurons and make the right connections. So that is a big area of study in neuroscience, too. How do the axons grow out from the developing neurons and find their way to the right targets? And again, we could have a whole lecture about axon pathfinding. To simplify the system, rather than looking at a whole embryo, in this case, scientists placed neurons, young neurons, before the axons grew out, into a culture dish. And you've probably seen these on shows of where they have scientists sitting at a work area that's enclosed in glass, and there's dishes of pink liquid, and they're pipetting them up and down. That's cell culture, and this is a figure from a paper studying how axons grow out of neurons in cell culture. So over a period of an hour, here we have 15-minute intervals, we can see, so the neuron is out of the field. It would be down here somewhere. Here's just the axon growing out, and it's attached to the surface by the structure called the growth cone, and it is gradually moving forward in a particular direction. So this is a very simplified model system that's very useful for experimenting, seeing what makes an axon grow one way or the other. And we've learned that there are a lot of protein molecules that are produced by other cells in a growing embryo, if you can imagine how this would be growing in the presence of other cells and other neurons. A lot of signaling between the cells that allows the growing end of the axon essentially to sort of feel and even taste its way along the other cells and along the other proteins in the embryo to find its target. And once it gets there, it has to pick among many targets, and there's a lot of additional levels of interaction that are required in actually refining the final set of wiring in our brains. Wiring really isn't these aren't really like wires. I know sometimes we as shorthand, talk about electrical signals going down axons, but in fact, it's, the transmission of information along an axon is really not at all like electricity going along a wire. It's true that there are electrical charges involved, but they're not, for the most part, moving the length of the axon. The important part is that they move from the outside to the inside and from the inside to the outside, and this area of depolarization moves along the axon. It's really more like a row of dominoes falling over than it is like electrons zipping through a wire. But it turns out that both for electrical wires and for axons, it's important that they have insulation around them. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit because it leads us to talking about some recent developments, recent findings, understanding about how the human brain develops for quite a number of years. So going back to forming the insulation around our axons, in our brain and spinal cord, that's done by a cell called the oligodendrocyte. That's a long name, and what it really means is a cell with few branches. And so there are a number of processes that come out from the cell body, and they form sort of flattened sheets that actually wrap around individual axons. And it turns out that when the oligodendrocyte does this and makes these regions with just a little bit of exposed axon in between them, it allows the information, the depolarization, to jump from one of these nodes to the next, which makes information go through our nervous systems much faster than it would otherwise. So the myelination is very important. So there's a fairly common disease that occurs when something goes wrong with the oligodendrocytes and with the myelination. Does anybody know what that is in human disease? Did somebody say multiple sclerosis? That's right, yeah. Multiple sclerosis is a disease of oligodendrocytes. And we don't know what causes it, but somehow people with MS, their immune system starts to attack their oligodendrocytes and damages the myelin. So we can see then that that's really an important part of the system. I was talking about embryonic development, how axons have to find their way through the embryo and how myelination happens to them shortly after that. But I think it's probably more interesting to most of us to think about brain wiring changes and brain development that happens after we're born or after we're embryos. And it turns out that a lot of brain development in humans continues for some months after birth. And there are certain aspects of brain development that continue for quite a few years. So if we look at some of the landmarks here, here's the internal capsule. So we already learned about the internal capsule. We know that that's what? That's a fiber tract. That's a bunch of myelinated axons that are running up and down. And if we look at the individual that's 5 months here, we see that it's visible, but it's much thinner there than it is in the two-year-old. So the point here is that if we compare the five-month-old to the two-year-old, there is much more of this myelination, white matter, evident after 2 years. So this tells us clearly that myelination, a lot of myelination, is going on within the first 2 years of life. So if you have younger brothers or sisters or even young kids of your own and they're at that age, it's fun to think about how their neurological development is really reflecting anatomical changes, wiring changes, insulation changes that are going on in their brains. But before you start thinking that your brains are all mature, I know that I can see there's a lot of you here are under 20 years old, I'm guessing. And some pretty recent work has, with MRI imaging, has shown that our brains continue to mature in a couple of ways, a number of ways, well into adolescence and through adolescence. We can see that the big difference here is that by 20 years is that this really is showing the gray matter volume. So the gray matter is, the relative amount of gray matter is being reduced, and that's due to at least a couple of things, that some of the connections between neurons are being eliminated. We have fewer connections between our neurons when we're adult than we are when we're kids. And also, the amount of white matter is increasing. The amount of myelination, as we just saw, continues to increase even after the two-year time point. And it's interesting, then, even more so, to look at where these changes are occurring over time. So these regions that are that are at their adult maturity relatively early are ones that we looked at earlier in this talk. That was our somatosensory and motor cortex, the part of our brain that controls our movement and that gets sensory input from our bodies. And then this is the area that's called the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex, we'll talk about it a bit more coming up, is the part of our brain that's involved with personality and insight and planning. And it's also important for inhibition of impulsive behavior. So we can see that that is the last part of the brain to become fully myelinated and to fully take on the mature characteristics. So there's more and more realization, I think, that teenagers sometimes show poor judgment, probably because the prefrontal cortex of the brain doesn't actually mature until we're in our 20s. So that's just something to think about when you're either trying to understand your own behavior or those of other people you know. There may really be a reason why we act different when we're younger, and it's not just because we have more to learn. It's because the part of our brain that's involved in exercising judgment is one of the last to mature. Yeah?
Is it possible for different people, and not all, I mean, you're assuming not all people's brains develop at the same rate?
Oh, right, yeah. The question is not all people's brains develop at the same rate, and that's absolutely true. As I said, this is the average of I don't know how many individuals in this study. But, yeah, one wouldn't want to make assumptions about any one person based on this average.
What yeah. would speed up a brain development?
Why would one person be different from another?
Yeah.
It could be any number of reasons, and we don't. You know, I would only be speculating because that would be a hard experiment to do. You'd have to really control people's environment and have them genetically identical or inbred or something to do that. So, yeah, it's hard to do the really interesting experiments on people sometimes. A little bit more about things going on during human brain development. We now know that we continue to form new neurons in our brain throughout life. And this is a pretty revolutionary finding. When I went to school, they said, you're born with all the neurons you'll ever have and you don't get any more. But in the last 10, 15 years, it's been pretty clearly demonstrated that even in humans, there are some places in the brain where we do get new neurons. One of these places is the hippocampus. The hippocampus is one of the places in our brain where new neurons are formed every day. So we'll keep that in mind when we look at the structure and the function of the hippocampus. Neurons migrate in their positions relatively early in development, and that axon and dendrite sprouting continues well into our postnatal period. So again, we're forming new connections even after we're born, and the synapses continue to be formed throughout life. Myelination, has an intense period in the first year or two of life, but it also continues to some extent throughout life. We lose cells. Programmed cell death, shown here, is a feature of fetal brain development that we don't see later on. And this may seem like, why would the developing brain want to have cells dying? Well, it turns out that this is one of the mechanisms that has evolved to ensure that the brain develops with enough neurons. It starts out producing more than it needs, and then based on how the cells interact with each other as they're making their connections, many of them die off. It may seem inefficient, but it turns out that it works. Along the same lines, many of the axons that first grow out from neurons are later retracted, and we can see that happens. This refinement of the wiring is a major part of what's going on postnatally. And then besides actual retraction of axons, the synapses, the connections from one axon to another neuron, are refined or pruned. This is referred to as pruning by neuroscientists throughout childhood. And then very interestingly, in adolescence, there appears to be a burst and intensification of synapse elimination. So these events shape the final connectivity in our brain. I think it's important to note that new connections are being made and broken in our brains every day. Neuroscientists, by and large, think that the process that causes us to be able to form new memories that we can later recall, by which our daily experiences leave an imprint on our memory, is by changes in synapses, new synapses forming, existing synapses weakening or being lost. Somehow, all the trillions of synapses constantly being active and then either being strengthened or weakened in our brain somehow encodes our memories and our experience and all of our knowledge. And so that's one of the major challenges for neuroscience now, is to really understand how consciousness, how memory and thought is encoded at the level of synapses. Okay, so we had two answers for why our brains are wired the way that they are. It's because they evolve that way, and it's because they develop that way, and they continue to develop and lose connections. Another way of answering this question of why is, of course, because it depends on our genes. Within certain limits, our genes pretty much directly control what all of our cells do. Our genes control the developmental and physiological processes that result in brain wiring. So we're kind of answering this question in layers. We'll give one answer and then sort of build on that. So our genes control the developmental processes. We just looked at the developmental processes, and there are specific patterns of gene expression in neurons that correlate with those particular developmental activities. We also said that this is the way our brains evolved. And, of course, our genes are the result of our current genome is the result of years of evolution that has selected for this certain set of genes. So evolution, development, and genetics are really all related answers, very closely related answers. We don't yet really know very well how genes account for brain wiring or brain function. We're starting to get some clues about it, and one way is to look at situations where the brain developed abnormally and then try to find, and to look, especially in cases where it looks like that's a hereditary abnormality rather than just a random abnormality. So if there's a family where you see a pattern of a certain kind of brain abnormality, you can do sophisticated genetic studies to identify where the mutation might be in the genome. And that's starting to give us some information about candidate genes that are likely to control brain development. Both of these patients had a condition called lissencephaly. And lissencephaly, if you were to take a a person who died, a person with less than 7 died, and open up the skull and look at the brain, what you see is that the brain is quite smooth. Our brains have a lot of what are called gyri and sulci, folds and grooves. I just call them noodles when I'm talking to the medical students. So our brains have a lot of noodles, but the lissencephalic patients have relatively smooth brain surfaces. So there's something that developed abnormally in these patients, and also the thickness of the wall of the cerebral hemisphere is abnormally large. So this brain is more severely affected in the posterior, and this brain is more severely affected in the anterior. And interestingly, even though both of these patients have a form of lissencephaly that appears quite similar, it looks like there are two different mutations. This one is called the LIS1 gene. It was identified based on looking at families where lissencephaly tended to run in it, and they didn't know that there was this gene there before, but they were able to find it by modern positional cloning methods. So it's by looking at mutations in families where they have consistent brain abnormalities appearing from time to time, we can use that to track down genes that then it just seems logical that if the gene is mutated and we get the brain abnormality, then the normal gene plays some role in normal brain development. And once we know that, we can study that gene more carefully, see what sort of protein it encodes, where that protein is present in cells. Is that protein related to similar proteins in experimental animals that we can study more easily? And by asking those kinds of questions, we can really get at the role of an individual gene and to see how it controls brain development. So this is an exciting new area of work. Of course, now with the human genome being fully sequenced, and now that we've got the sequence, we can really start to ask questions and see what a particular sequence region would be doing. So there's lots of opportunity to combine our past understanding of human abnormalities with the new genomic work to try to get at the underlying genetic basis of the abnormalities and, again, the normal brain development as well. Lissencephaly is relatively uncommon, but I bet you can probably think of a human condition, hereditary condition to some extent, that probably affects brain wiring. Was anybody listening to public radio this evening? They mentioned autism. We don't really know what is the underlying anatomical cause of autism. There's some evidence that there are abnormalities in the connectivity between different brain regions, either too many axons or too few, depending on which study. But we're now in a position to start trying to understand the genetic basis of autism. This has been going on for a long time, and it has been very slippery to get an answer. This diagram is from a real recent paper that just came out in August, I believe, in Nature Neuroscience or Nature Medicine, that reported one of these genome-wide association studies. So you tend to read about these kinds of studies more and more. You pick up a paper and they'll say scientists have screened a large population in a genome-wide association study and found a gene for whatever. It's a very powerful tool where we can go in knowing essentially nothing about the location of genes, and just by correlating particular markers that have been identified on genes, which is just a little sequence tag. We don't know that it means anything, but if we can correlate that particular little sequence tag with either the presence or the absence of a condition and do it across thousands and thousands of people, you can get to the point where you have statistically good indication that that region of that chromosome has something to do with that condition, and then you can start to look at it more closely. So these genome-wide association screens are leading us to candidate genes. We can combine this information with other kinds. Cytogenetic analysis refers to looking at chromosomes under a microscope and seeing if there are abnormalities. So if a child is born who has some sort of hereditary abnormality, often one of the first things they'll do is to get a cell sample and look at the chromosomes under a microscope to see if there have been rearrangements, part of a chromosome lost or turned around And that break point where the chromosome broke could be a clue to a particular gene that was affected, leading to that abnormality. Other kinds of clinical studies and our knowledge of genes from lots of developmental biology all come together to give us ideas about new candidate genes. A word of caution, though, you know, when scientists first started doing these genome-wide association studies, say, 5 years ago, they thought, okay, now this is going to crack it wide open. Now we're going to quickly find the gene behind all kinds of genetic diseases. And it turned out that, you know, once people started actually getting some papers out, that it was actually a lot harder than had been thought to clearly identify genes. So a word of caution, these genome-wide association studies turn up a lot of clues that for whatever reason don't pan out. We don't really understand why, but we need to follow them up with lots more specific studies. I'm going to switch gears a little bit now, and I think I have time to keep talking for a while. Neuroanatomy in the news. So, you know, it seems like more and more your educated American newspaper reader or person listening to public radio hears lots of neuroanatomy being tossed around. It's like we're expected to know, you know, where is the lateral geniculate nucleus and what does it do? And so I'm going to help you out with this. I just sat down at my computer the other day, and I read the New York Times just about every day. And the New York Times has pretty good coverage of science. There's a lot of neuroscience stories that it includes from time to time. So I just, starting from now, going back to the beginning of 2009, did a search for brain research in the New York Times. And I came up with a dozen or so articles where I found where they're specifically mentioning particular neuroanatomical structures. So I've taken quotes from those, and we're going to try to bring you up to speed. We're a little primer here on neuroanatomy that you need to know to read the New York Times. Okay, let's read the paper. October 1st, New York Times. Sensitivity trainer's advice for traffic agents. Mayor Michael R. Bloomberg wants the city's 2,795 traffic enforcement agents to undergo sensitivity training. The trainer would explain to the agents what happens in the amygdala, the portion of the brain, quote, responsible for assessing threats. Amygdala. We didn't see that up there. I can tell you that wasn't on there. And that's because the amygdala, it's not a surface structure. It's a deep structure in the cerebral hemisphere. It's actually located deep in the temporal lobe, close to the medial surface of the temporal lobe, but it's buried and you can't see it. So that's where your amygdala is. Also pay attention to where your hippocampus is. It's this curvy thing that runs deep in the temporal lobe. So we talked about the hippocampus being important for memory, and we said that it's one place where new neurons are produced all the time in our brains. And we just said that the amygdala is involved in fear and anxiety responses. Okay, so there's some neuroanatomy to take away with you. New York Times, September 28th. After a death, the pain that doesn't go away. This talked about people who seem to suffer from intense and unremitting grief following a loss of, say, a loved one. When patients with complicated grief looked at pictures of their loved ones, the nucleus accumbens, the part of the brain associated with rewards or longing, lighted up. Okay, so what do we mean by lighted up? You read this all the time. And, of course, earlier in the article it would have said that they were doing some kind of functional imaging, just like we were looking at earlier with the, we're showing that where the language area was in the left side of the brain because that area was more active when language tasks were being done. Same thing, they would do functional imaging and see that the nucleus accumbens was more active. The part of the brain associated with rewards or longings. Another reason that you might read about the nucleus accumbens is because it's an important part of the brain that's involved with substance abuse and addiction. And it appears that the nucleus accumbens is sort of a center for all kinds of, you know, reward. So it's rewarding to satisfy our regular drives, feeding drive, our sex drive, and also lots of behaviors that we just find rewarding, like going shopping or any kind of, you know, sort of novel thing often produces activity in the nucleus accumbens. So it's a region that you'll read about quite a bit. So where is that nucleus accumbens? And what's special about it? This is the internal capsule. And if we look at this region more closely, we see that this, here's the putamen, here's the caudate nucleus, and this part where they come together is the nucleus accumbens. So it's deep down in the brain, buried in all of this white matter of this cerebral hemisphere. Nucleus accumbens, the legend here says, mapping the distribution of a particular type of dopamine receptor, the D3 receptor, that has been implicated in reward circuitry, the kind of reward behavior that I was just talking about. In frontal sections of normal brain, the receptor is, the where it's highlighted with the redder color, is preferentially found in the nucleus accumbens. And on the image next to it here is the same sort of section from the brain of a chronic cocaine user who died from a cocaine overdose. And we see even higher concentrations of D3 dopamine receptors in this region. So this is consistent with what we think about how drug addictions work, that it actually changes the nature of our neurons. It changes the way that they respond to stimuli and actually causes an increase in the number of receptors that it hijacks our normal reward responses and makes it so other kinds of normally rewarding activities are less rewarding, and the only thing that somebody with this kind of condition would find as rewarding would be to continue to use the drug. So it's interesting that in the story that led us to this was about people who are experiencing great grief. It's almost as though they're so rewarded by thoughts of their loved one who's no longer there that to not have that is very painful for them. Form of addiction. Okay, New York Times, August 8th, 2009. After injury, fighting to regain a sense of self. This was a story about a young man who had a car accident, some sort of similar head trauma, and had brain injury. And afterwards, after he recovered, largely recovered, he had a particular kind of neurological disorder where he had trouble believing that he was who he was and that his family and his friends were who they said they were. He thought that they were imposters, that you're not really my sister. My sister doesn't look like you. So issues of identity, both of the patient and making identity with former acquaintances and family. In this case, the editors of the New York Times were thoughtful enough to give us a little neuroanatomy guide. So here's the frontal and medial temporal areas. Okay, all right. I think we know enough anatomy now. Just looking at this frontal pole of the prefrontal cortex, this is a combination of a lot of data, 104 different imaging studies from 1995 to 2005 combined to produce a map indicating where blood flow, again, that's the most common way of looking at brain activity, was most likely to increase during three kinds of tasks. Memory tasks, shown in the blue highlighting here. So those are not in the midline. Different studies had multiple tasks that the subjects were asked to form task switching, and those were localized to the frontal pole. And the name that's given here, mentalizing, is what was referred to in the story in the New York Times. Subjects inferred the mental or emotional states of themselves or others. Again, so this is identifying and being able to relate to the emotional states and also to understand that other people think the way we do. And so just as the New York Times article indicated, it localizes to these midline regions of the frontal lobe. New York Times, March 5th. converting cells shows promise for Parkinson's disease. This was a story about producing stem cells that could become new neurons in the substantia nigra. So it says, generating the dopamine-producing neurons of the substantia nigra, the brain region affected in Parkinson's disease. So Parkinson's disease is fairly common, and it's good to know that the substantia nigra is the site of the injury. So where is that? Let's get our neuroanatomy lined up there. Here's the brain stem. We're not looking at the cortex. And specifically, we're going to look at the midbrain. Specifically, we're going to look at the rostral midbrain. Rostral is just another way of saying towards the front, and caudal is a way of saying towards the back. Substantia nigra neurons have axons that grow throughout the brain, supplying different parts of the brain with this important neurotransmitter dopamine. And in this section, this is a post-mortem section, again, sliced through the rostral midbrain, of a patient who died with Parkinson's disease. And the normal brain has an area of dark staining neurons. That's why they call it substantia nigra, the black substance. And it's depleted on this side, and it's completely gone on the other side. So this is consistent with a patient who would have had severe Parkinson's disease, lost a lot of substantia nigra neurons. February 24th, 2009, Frito-Lay tries to enter the minds and lunch bags of women. So this is about marketing. This is a new thing that you'll hear about more and more. If doctors and researchers can use functional brain imaging to find out what part of our brain is most active when we're doing particular tasks, that has led marketing companies to want to use functional imaging to see what kind of advertising makes our brains light up the most. So you can expect more and more to see advertising directed at activating your brain regions. So here they were. The Frito-Lay company was trying to see how to advertise best to women. And they found that the kind of ads that women respond to best were quite different from ads that male subjects responded to. The hippocampus was proportionally larger in women, so they talked about the hippocampus. So we talked about, I showed you the cingulate gyrus going over the corpus callosum. Keep that in mind. The cingulate gyrus seems to come up pretty often in newspaper articles. I don't know why. I guess there's a lot going on there. It says, which processes decision-making and was larger in women. Decision-making, that sounds pretty sophisticated. But look, we're talking about the decision to buy or not to buy Fritos. So all kinds of decisions are processed there. And to get even more insight into decision processing in the cingulate cortex, here's an image from a textbook. Compilation of data from 5 functional imaging studies showing areas activated when subjects perceive their bladders to be full versus empty. And one of the areas there is the anterior cingulate gyrus. So that's a pretty important decision to be making, whether you need to empty your bladder or not. Okay, here's another one. February 16th, 2009. In pain and joy of envy, the brain may play a role. Talks about the higher the subjects rated their envy, the more vigorously flared the pain nodes in the brain's dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. Okay, there we go. Cingulate cortex again. And this time we're talking about not just the anterior cingulate cortex, but the dorsal part of it. So that, right, that's higher up. So I'm just trying to help you visualize all of these areas. It went on to say, subjects who felt the greatest envy reacted with comparatively lively response in the dopamine-rich pleasure centers of, for example, the ventral striatum. Now, we were just talking about dopamine receptors in a pleasure or reward center, but it wasn't called the ventral striatum. What was it called? N-A, it was abbreviated? It was the nucleus accumbens. Nucleus accumbens. So what's going on here? And here's a trick we pull on medical students. We give the same structure multiple names. So the ventral striatum is really essentially the same region as the nucleus accumbens. This is an interesting study. Varying sweat scents are scents, S-C-E-N-T-S, scents are noted by women. Two regions of the brain, the right orbital frontal cortex and the right fusiform region, respond significantly more to the sexual sweat of men than to any of the other smells. So this was an interesting study where they had men put absorbent pads under their arms and then either watch a video of neutral content or X-rated videos. And then they took the pads and gave them to women volunteers to smell. And they imaged the women's brains while they were doing this. And it says that they saw activity in the orbitofrontal cortex and the right fusiform regions. So these are tricky ones. You'd really have to be a pretty good neuroanatomist reading your newspaper to get these without help.
You've been listening to Dr. Tim Hinterberger, Associate Professor for the Alaska WAMI Biomedical Program and the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Dr. Hinterberger was the first of four premier Alaskan physicians to present at the 2009 Alaska WAMI Mini Medical School Series. Representing Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho, WAMI is a collaborative medical school among universities in five northwestern states, and this month they are hosting a public lecture series at Providence Hospital. Dr. Hinterberger's talk on Why Our Brains Are Wired the Way They Are was recorded this past Tuesday, October 6th, and was edited for radio broadcast on KSKA. If you'd like to find out more about the Alaska WAMI Mini Medical School Series happening this month in Anchorage, you can find a link on our website at kska.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.